Hi, this is Alan Chartok. Helen Epstein is the author of 6 books, including the multi-generational memoir, Where She Came From, A Daughter's Search for Her Mother's History, the first book on intergenerational trauma, Children of the Holocaust, and the biography, Joe Papp, An American Life. She also reviews theater and music in the Berkshires for the online arts magazine, The Arts Fuse. Helen grew up in Manhattan and bought a house in the Berkshires 35 years ago. She lives on Plunkett Lake in Hinsdale, where, with her husband Patrick Mayer, she founded Plunkett Lake Press, ebooks of life writing. They publish classic nonfiction literature, including books by and about Stefan Zweig, Karen Horney, and Eva Hoffman. She is now finishing a memoir about a long friendship with her first love, the son of blacklisted communist, and today she joins us to talk about her New Yorker magazine article about a former Nazi, Melita Mashman, who wrote a memoir about her experience called Account Rendered. Helen Epstein, wonderful to have you back with us again. It's always great when you're with us.
Thank you, Alan.
Well, it's a fascinating article that you wrote. I was a Nazi, and here's why. Take us from the beginning.
Well, my husband and I, as you said, started an ebook publishing enterprise at our home on Plunkett Lake, Plunkett Lake Press. And we were very interested in publishing really remarkable nonfiction that had kind of fallen by the wayside, either because the books went out of print or because the publishing industry is such a disaster. And my husband was interested in reading books that he had never read before. And so we asked around all our friends, what was one of the most interesting biographies or nonfiction books you ever read? And one of our friends told us about this memoir by a former Nazi named Melita Mashman. I had never heard of Melita Mashman, even though this is an area where I've done a lot of reading. I'm the daughter of Holocaust survivors. Most of my family was murdered by the Nazis. So I've done quite a bit of reading about this, and I was really surprised that I had never heard of this woman. Turned out, Melita Mashman was one of the few people, and certainly one of the few women, who admitted to being a Nazi and wrote a book about it in the early 1960s. And so we tried to find this book, which was difficult in and of itself. We found the book. I found it extremely difficult to read. The reason I found it difficult to read was, on the one hand, I identified a lot with her. She started her story when she was 15 years old. She was going to a school for gifted girls in Berlin in the 1930s, and she wrote her book as a letter to her best friend in that school when she was 15 in 1933.
So, you know, I was fascinated by your writing because I began to create alternative theories of why she was motivated to do what she did. Now, tell us what she came up with in the book itself.
Well, what she said was that after 12 years in the Hitler Youth, she was in the Hitler Youth from the age of 15 to the age of 27, and she joined the Hitler Youth not because her family was pro-Nazi. Her family was not pro-Nazi. She joined the Hitler Youth as a kind of rebellion against her family, very much like kids of the 60s were rebelling against their conservative parents. So that was, again, a point of identification for me. She joined the Hitler Youth kind of for feminist reasons, because the Hitler Youth provided a pathway for her as a young woman to do what she liked to do, which was to write, of course. And that was another point of identification for me. Here she was, this young girl who wanted to be a journalist, and the Hitler Youth offered her a position in press and propaganda. And so it was like a long internship in our terms. And so she was drawn to it for that reason. So all of that, I was all there with her. The part, of course, where I parted company with her, and which was very difficult for me to understand, was that she was buying into this incredibly racist ideology, which, as a smart young woman, she must have been cognizant of. And then after she worked in press and propaganda, she was put in charge of the eviction of Polish farmers from their farms and the resettlement of ethnic Germans onto those farms. So basically, she directed a small part of ethnic cleansing at the age of 20 and 21, which is also, I mean, from our point of view, here you look at a 20-year-old young woman basically evicting middle-aged farmers and bringing in German ethnics into that land. And she must have had an enormous sense of power. So what she does in her memoir is she tries to look at what she did and not excuse it, as she says, but explain it. And for the reader, it's an extremely painful and difficult and challenging read. And I really would like to know how you felt about it, what your theories are, because, you know, for me, I had such a hard time just reading it because I had so many conflicting reactions to it.
You know, before we get to what I thought, can we just go back to the story that you tell about her and her friend, her Jewish friend?
Okay, so the book is written as a letter, essentially, to this 15-year-old girl with whom she had been so close in this high school. This 15-year-old girl named Marianne, who she does not name in the book, was actually a real person, although for many years, for decades, critics thought that perhaps she was a convention or a construct. Many critics didn't buy the idea that this book was really to a real person. They thought that it was a literary convention, that Melita Mashman wrote this book as a letter for devious reasons, and that her friend really never existed, or if she existed, she was a composite. And of course, literary critics had a lot of fun with this because that's what they do. They theorize, and they had a theory that this woman never existed. At any rate, when we published the book, because I am a journalist by training, one of the things I did was really follow up any leads about, was this truly written to a person or was it a literary construct? And after a lot of legwork, I located a literary critic in Germany who, in one of the essays she had read, saw a footnote about this person, and the name in the footnote was Marianne Schweitzer. And we then hit the internet and we found Marianne Schweitzer living in La Jolla, California at the age of 95, which was a real thrill. And so we called her up and
she almost hung up on you, right?
She almost hung up on us because my husband called and she thought he was a telemarketer. And we said, wait a minute. We're calling about a memoir that is allegedly written to you. Is this correct? And she said, well, yes, of course. It's Melita Mushman's memoir. So we got this incredible story. Marianne Schweitzer, who lives in La Jolla and still volunteers at the San Diego Museum of Man, and does yoga every week. 95 years old. She's an extremely active, totally with it person. She's a Yale graduate, got her master's in anthropology at Yale, Bryn Mawr graduate, undergraduate degree from Bryn Mawr. She told us the whole story from her point of view, and she basically validated the whole story. She was best friends with this girl when she was 15. Marianne, who turns out not to have been 100% Jewish, she was 50% Jewish according to Hitler. Her father was a baptized Jew in Berlin. And it came as a great shock to her at the age of 15 to find out she was Jewish. And basically, she says that everything that Melita wrote about her is correct, and she can't validate that everything Melita wrote about herself is correct, but she thinks that it was an effort in good faith to explain how a teenager under Nazism could join the Hitler Youth.
And what was that explanation?
The explanation was that it was a combination of rebellion against her parents, being drawn to a movement larger than herself, being drawn to the parades, to the torchlight, to the ideology, to the idea of redeeming a nation that had been humiliated in the First World War. All of that I really get. What's really difficult to understand is how Melita totally dissociated and denied the racist ideology, how she could participate in ethnic cleansing and believe she was resettling people. She didn't have much to do with Jews. She was never near a concentration camp. She does describe seeing a ghetto at some point, and she has a very
Nazi-influenced reaction to the Jews she sees in the ghetto. She wonders why they're not working, why they're just hanging out. And she doesn't understand why they're so dirty. And she doesn't get what the ghetto is, or she doesn't want to get what the ghetto is. But apart from that, she does not have much interaction with Jews. Her major activity during the war was in press and propaganda, so she was in an office writing, or she was in that Polish town resettling Polish farmers.
I interviewed Susan Dunn recently about her book 1940, and we were talking about, you know, the post-Nazi years, and we began to talk about whether or not the next generation were sincere in their repentance and rejection of Nazism. And I raised one of those things that we political scientists used to talk about in the old days, which were the concept of national character. And Susan took the other road. She said, nope, she really felt that the post-generation, German generation, was out of that and really was truly upset about what had happened. And I just had one sentence, which was, I'm not so sure. I get a telephone call from a woman who heard it, and she's infuriated with me, because she said that while her family were Nazis and while they all went off to fight and many of them got killed, and, you know, Helen, nobody is more of an expert on this than you are. You know, we didn't know. We knew nothing. We had no idea that this kind of stuff. You didn't know about Kristallnacht. You didn't know, well, that was in the city and when you were in cities, and we didn't know in the country and the rest of it, and you're being unfair and the rest of it. I'm fascinated about what would make this woman write a book called Fazit, or Account Rendered, and whether or not it could just be convenient. You know, the war's over. I was with the Nazis when they were the Nazis, and now I'll go one better and prove that I've been really denazified and truly repentant. You know, maybe is it true? Maybe not. I have real feelings about how opportunistic some of this stuff can be.
Well, I guess listening to you, certainly I've heard people say exactly what you've said, not only about this book, but about Germany in general and Germans in general. I guess I feel, as a writer, that anybody's motivations are extremely complex and often rational as well as irrational. And often one's motivations are clear to oneself, and sometimes they don't become clear until years later. Sure. I mean, you know, I've had the experience of writing books and not understanding sentences I've written until 20 years later. Mm. So I think it's very hard to pinpoint one motivation to a writer or to ascribe one motivation to a writer. I think my own theory about these two women, I think that in girls' high schools, I went to an all-girls high school, so this is very personal to me. One tends to make very, very, very intense attachments. I know that I'm still in touch now at the age of 65 with girls who I knew when I was 15 years old.
Everybody's screaming at the radio and saying, where did you go?
Oh, sorry. I went to Hunter High School in New York City, which was then an all-girls school.
Indeed.
And she went to an all-girls school in Berlin, you know, which must have been very similar to Hunter High School. And I remember the kinds of relationships we had. I mean, they were so intense. I mean, we had intense intellectual relationships. We had intense emotional relationships. And I think, you know, even beyond what these two girls had, I think Melita was probably a lesbian back then. She never married. She was very involved with women all through her life. We didn't mention that after the war, she was arrested by the American army. She was denazified. And soon after she wrote this memoir, she became a follower of a woman guru and moved to India to an ashram. And before she did that, she had gotten involved with another Holocaust survivor whom she met in Germany. Now, the reason we know all of this stuff about Melita is not only due to Mariana, who we tracked down in La Jolla, but we also obtained the rights to the book from Melita's nephew, who is a German, actually television producer, who lives in Paris and has lived in Paris for 25 years. And so we spoke to him last month, actually, at length, in person, in Paris, about his aunt.
And we asked the same questions you did. You know, we asked, first of all about her. Then we asked all about him, how he feels as a German who's now in his 50s, who has his own children. One of the interesting things we discovered was that Melita's book is excerpted in French textbooks about the war. And because Mashman is such a strange name in Paris, clearly foreign, Felix Mashman's nephew's son in high school was reading this excerpt in class, and his teacher or somebody in his class asked, "Are you related to Melita Mashman, to the writer whose excerpt we are now reading in this history book about the Second World War?" And so this is not a theoretical question. This is really very live in people's lives all over the world. This book, Fazit, has been excerpted by lots of people. Daniel Goldhagen excerpted it, parts of it, used it as a primary source in his book about Nazism. And it's used in places like Poland and Holland in teaching about the war. So we got into a conversation with Melita Mashman's nephew in Paris about why he was living in Paris for 25 years. He said he had a lot of trouble living in Germany because of the war. And he, like many Germans who are in their 40s and 50s and early 60s, find it very, very problematic on a continuing basis to be German. And they think about it a lot. They talk about it a lot. And it's an ongoing identity issue. So I guess I don't think there's one kind of response in Germany to Nazism. I think there are many responses, and I think there are many people who were born after the war who are still struggling with the issue. And of course, I hear from a lot of them because I wrote Children of the Holocaust, sure, which is about kids of Jews whose families were murdered in the war. But I also hear from kids of Nazis.
So, she got quite beaten up, intellectually, I should say, by people who thought she was a traitor for having written this.
Right.
Tell us about that.
I mean, what Marianne Schweitzer pointed out to me was that in the 1960s, there were very few people coming out and saying, "I was a Nazi." Mm. And I think in Europe in general, it is so difficult to take a public stand about any aspect of what you did during the war. I mean, there's this wonderful woman, Irena Sendler, in Poland, who helped some thousands of Jewish children escape. And she never came out as a rescuer in Poland because she just didn't want to be bothered. She didn't want the controversy because the war, the Second World War in Europe is still so alive, the wounds are still so raw, mm-hmm, that nobody wants to come out, as we do in this country, and make all mm-hmm kinds of pronouncements about it because it's just too close.
So how did she handle the attacks?
Melita Mashman?
Yes.
The way Melita Mashman handled the attacks was she got out of the country. I think that was one of the reasons that she found this Indian guru. She could never find a place for herself after the war because some people shunned her because she had been a Nazi. Some people shunned her because she said she was a Nazi and she talked about what she had done. So it was kind of a no man's land for her. It couldn't have been very comfortable being a lesbian in post-war Germany. And she became a follower of this Indian woman guru and essentially moved to India. She only returned to Germany in 2010 when she had Alzheimer's, which is kind of ironic. She couldn't remember most of what she had done during her life. And she went into the care of her family, her remaining family in Germany. But she had basically got out of Germany from 1964 to 2010.
We're talking with Helen Epstein, author and theater and music reviewer and a friend of this radio station, because this is not the first time we've talked to you, Helen.
And contributor, I should say.
and you are always so clear. And so that's why I love having you on, because I want to ask you about both sides. You know, my father would not get in my Volkswagen.
Right.
He wouldn't. And he just wouldn't. And he didn't take stands on many things, but he took it on that. And so we have this woman. She comes out with this memoir. It's excerpted all over the place. It's in children's books. It's in around, as you say, France and these other places. And yet I'm still not clear as to what her motivation was in writing it. You say maybe it's not clear to her.
Right. I think there are many motivations, Alan. I think when a writer writes a book, I don't think there's one reason. I think there are many reasons, and some of those reasons aren't available to the writer consciously at the time they're writing. But let me say one other thing, which I haven't maybe said explicitly enough. I believe, and this is my theory, I have no evidence for this, I believe that Melita Mushman was in love with Marianne Schweitzer from the time that they were 15 years old.
Interesting.
I think she never stopped being in love with her. I think that she felt that she had betrayed her best friend. She betrayed her in a number of ways. She betrayed her, number one, by becoming a Nazi. That's a very big deal. But the second way she betrayed her was much more personal. At one point in 1937, and she writes about this, she confesses, she's approached by the Gestapo, and she's told to spy on Marianne Schweitzer's family. And Marianne Schweitzer has an older sister who's very politically active. Now, remember, Marianne Schweitzer's family are half and half Jews. 50%, according to Hitler, they're not Jewish. 50%, they're totally Aryan. And Marianne's older sister is an anti-Nazi activist. And the Gestapo suspects them of having illegal meetings in their house. So they ask, or they tell Melita to go spy on them. And as a result of, not as a result of Melita being there, but at the same time that Melita spies on them, the Gestapo conducts a raid on the house, and Marianne's older sister gets put in prison in the first concentration camp for women, actually, for 6 months, and Marianne's mother is put in jail for 2 weeks. This is in 1937. This is before Kristallnacht. This is a very big deal. I mean, she must have been carrying around guilt for this for many, many, many years. And although it wasn't cause and effect, it wasn't because Melita was there that the mother and the sister were put in jail, it happened at the same time. And she must have been carrying around huge amounts of guilt about that. You know, all of us have had a best friend in our younger years who has stayed in our minds all our lives. I mean, I have several people like this, some of whom I'm still close to, some of whom have left my life. But I think about them all the time. And I think if you're a writer and you've lived through this kind of history and you've had this kind of interaction with your best friend and her family, you know, you're going to write a book about it.
Helen Epstein, let me ask you this. Hitler, we know what his position on the gays were. What about his position on lesbians?
I really couldn't answer that. I just don't have enough information, but I'm sure some academic has written a doctoral dissertation about it. Yeah. I really don't know. My impression is that lesbians were able to pass much more easily than male homosexuals, but I really don't know.
The reason I ask you that, of course,
whatever I say.
The reason I ask you that, of course, is because, and I'm sure you follow this, is because of your thesis that, you know, it was either a lesbian affair or close to a lesbian affair.
Well, we know it was not a lesbian affair because Marianne says that she was never a lesbian and that she, in fact, was married twice. But she also sort of thinks that Melita was a lesbian. And her nephew, Felix, in Paris, confirms that she had lesbian affairs.
Marianne does not get back to her the way that she had hoped. That's part of your story.
No, Marianne, at age 95, when I spoke to her from La Jolla, said, I admired Melita for writing her memoir. I thought it was a brave thing to do. I think she's an intelligent woman. She was my best friend back when we were 15, but I cannot forgive her. I cannot deal with her. And she never wrote back to her about the book.
What do you make of that?
What do I make of that? I make of that that people do what they can do and they shouldn't be asked to do more. I think that Marianne came to America. She made a fantastic life for herself in America. I mean, while her friend Melita was evicting Polish farmers from their farms, Marianne was at Bryn Mawr getting a degree and then at Yale getting a degree. I think that the irony of this whole story about these two girlfriends who met when they were 15 is how history completely sent them off on these really, really different paths. I mean, I think it would be a great movie, but of course nobody makes movies about stories about two women's friendships. But I think it would be a great movie. It's kind of like the movie Julia, but with a really different twist.
Let's talk a little bit about you, Helen Epstein. You've written a lot on the Holocaust, an important work on the Holocaust. As an author, how does this publication of this book, which you and your husband have done, and your interview and your basically your very good analysis of the whole thing, how does that fit in with what, everything you've done before? Things grow on each other, don't they?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, look, you write a book like Children of the Holocaust, and I was 26, 27 when I was writing it. And nothing prepares you for the reaction. I mean, I got such, you know, people, I would go to book signings. People would burst into tears when they saw me. People would tell me that I changed their lives. I was teaching at NYU then. I was a journalism professor. People would walk into my office and do really weird things. Some guy came in and said, I want to marry you. I said, do you have any? We just met, you know. I mean, it was real. It had a huge impact on people. And then when I wrote Where She Came From, which is a book that I go back to Central Europe and I really trace my family roots because, like many kids of survivors, I was very, and because of the Cold War, I was very separated from my history. I couldn't go to Czechoslovakia like everybody goes to Ireland to look at their roots. You know, you couldn't get there. So I finally, after 1989, I went back and I really tracked my maternal history. I knew more about my father's history because my father was an Olympic swimmer and he came from a rich family. And so everything was documented. But my mother's family was not well documented. So I did all of that. And then I had to deal with all the reaction of all the Czechs I met. I mean, you know, for the Czechs, I was like a Native American coming back to reclaim my ancestral lands. It was really funny, you know. I mean, I'd go to the very small town where my great-grandmother was born, and people stared at me as though I were a ghost. And they kept asking me, you know, where did I live, and why was I doing this, and what did I hope to find? And, you know, they were very helpful, but they clearly saw me as an exotic. I mean, I could have been wearing feathers. It was amazing, you know. People looked at me, examined me, and tried to find Jewish traits in my face. And I don't have a very large nose, and they thought that, you know, Jews had the large noses. And the funniest thing was they expected me to tell jokes because in Czech tradition, Jews tell humorous anecdotes. I am one of the worst joke tellers in the world, so they were very disappointed.
What would your folks have said about Melita?
What would my folks have said about Melita? My guess is my father just would not have read it. He just could not. It was so painful to him. You know, his entire family was exterminated by the Nazis. My father was the only survivor of his family. And he just would have found it too painful to read. My mother, who went through about 4 years of psychoanalysis in the 50s and was very literary, she read everything. I think she would have read it. I think she would have found it very difficult. And my mother always said that she felt sorry for the kids of Nazis because of all they were born into that they really had no responsibility for. And I guess that made a big impression on me as a child. But I have to say, I'm a kind of combination of my mother and father. I found this book incredibly difficult to read, this memoir of Melita Moshman's, and I probably would not have published it if my husband hadn't thought it was such a good thing to do.
What in particular was so difficult for you?
I just find it very difficult to identify with someone in so many ways and then watch her doing things that I am just appalled by, you know? The business of her walking into this Polish village and throwing out all these families who are twice as, you know, the owners of these farms are twice, three times as old as she is, and they've lived there forever. She doesn't even speak their language. She doesn't speak Polish, you know, and she's basically evicting them. And she describes it, and it's just horrendous to read. You don't want people who you admire in some ways to be so unadmirable in other ways. It's very difficult to take in. And I was very aware of that as I was reading, probably because as a writer, I identified with another woman writer.
You just mentioned that your mother had had 4 years of psychoanalysis. Was that directly related to working out the Holocaust?
Absolutely. Absolutely. My mother was an only child.
She was very, very, very involved with her parents because she was a dress designer and my grandmother was a dress designer. And they were partners in a fashion salon in Prague. I write all about this and where mm-hmm. she came from. And when they were all deported, as Prague Jews, they were deported to Theresienstadt. And when they got to Theresienstadt, she was separated from her parents in a very brutal way. They got basically pink slips to be deported. And she stayed because she was married to a man who was in Theresienstadt already. And that was the most horrendous part of her life. And she always blamed herself for not going to Auschwitz. It wasn't Auschwitz, actually. Her parents were not deported to Auschwitz.
You say blamed herself. Blamed herself, you
she
mean?
She blamed herself for not going or for not saving them. I mean, it was totally irrational. But her failure to go to be murdered with her parents was a major, major issue for her all her life. She thought she should not have survived. She had a very, very personalized form of survivor guilt. And that's one of the reasons she went to analysis. The other reason was she was just incredibly, incredibly depressed. And I was a small child at that point, and I had a younger brother, and she felt that she was an incompetent mother. So she went to analysis for that reason. The other problem, you know, which had nothing to do with the war, was that my father was unemployed for the first 10 years of my life. He was a water polo champion, and we were living in Manhattan. You know, I mean, and he didn't speak English. So she was working full time. She was a mother. My father, who was born in 1904, wasn't real good at housekeeping or at, you know, accommodating children. And so she really was a super mom in the 1950s when nobody was a super mom.
How did they survive? I mean, was her business good enough to carry you all over?
We were quite poor, and I became the family saver. I hoarded all my quarters that I got from my report cards when I got outstandings and things. Mm-hmm. And I remember a couple of times I would lend them money to pay the rent because I had a bank account.
Yeah. And what did that do to your father?
My father was, and again, here we are in one of these multi-variable situations. My father was the favorite son of his mother. He was a national water polo champion in Czechoslovakia. And he was, let's see, he was almost 40 when he was sent to concentration camp. So he had a full life before the war. And somehow that foundation was so much part of his personality that even when we were really poor and he was really unemployed for years and kept getting fired from jobs when he got them, he had this amazingly optimistic temperament. And if the sun was out, he went for a walk. If he could, he went for a swim. He was an amazing guy. In fact, that's why we got to the Berkshires, because in New York City, of course, it was difficult to find a good place to swim. And the reason they started renting little cabins in the Berkshires in the late 1950s was so he could swim across a lake.
Can we return, Helen Epstein, to motivation for Melita Mashman? What was it? I really am having a tough time with this whole business of what happens after the war. And, you know, you get Eisenhower's, you get the Russians moving in, you get everybody saying, if you are any kind of Nazi at all, you know, you're no good. So you have to convince everybody you're not a Nazi anymore. And she writes this thing.
Well, wait a minute. If you're in America, you're no good if you're a Nazi. If you're in Germany, if you're in a small town in Germany and everybody in town was a Nazi, then there's this kind of solidarity around people.
But
who
not
are
according
Nazis.
To the authorities. The authorities who are watching things say, you know, you want to go to America? If you haven't been denazified, you're not going.
That's right. But she didn't come to America. She stayed in Germany.
No, I know.
And then she
I
went
know.
To India.
No, I understand. But I'm honing in or trying to on motivation. You have articulated the idea that there are lots of motivations. I'm suggesting that, you know, in the same way they went along, oh, they weren't really Nazis. Their parents weren't Nazis. They went along with being a Nazi. I'm saying, you know, it just means it's too convenient to write this book.
Wait a minute. Yeah. Who are you talking about?
I'm talking
right
about
now.
Melita.
You're talking about Melita.
Yeah.
But Melita, I believe, is writing out of a combination of nostalgia for this woman who she loved as a 15-year-old, guilt as a person who was somehow complicit
with this woman's mother and sister being sent away. Also, she doesn't really know, as she's writing, where this 15-year-old friend of hers now is, what she's doing. She knows nothing about her. She wasn't even sure after the war whether this woman had survived. So there are so many threads of motivation in here. It isn't one thing. And you can't compare a writer who has remained in Germany to somebody who emigrated to the United States and maybe lied on their immigration form about why they were coming here. It's very different. You know, the Germans who stayed in Germany and the Germans who got out of Germany after the war or during the war, very different people. And it's so, so complicated. I mean, Marianne told us that in her own family, this is this half and half, half Aryan, half Jewish family, one of her brothers was killed on the Russian front serving in the Wehrmacht. So this half and half brother of Marianne's gets killed serving in the German army on the Russian front. Her older sister, who remained an anti-Nazi activist, remained in Germany during the war and stayed in Germany after the war, and her descendants live in Germany now. Then you have Melita had a twin brother. The twin brother had lung problems, and he was taken out of the army and sent to a sanatorium, luckily for him, during the war. And Felix, his son, so this is Melita's nephew, grows up in this family and says, I don't want to deal with any of this. I'm moving to Paris. And he becomes a television producer in Paris. You know, so you have lots of different reactions to this. You can't make a kind of stereotype of a German post-war, during war, pre-war, any more than you can about any of us Americans.
You wrote this for The New Yorker. And the title was, I Was a Nazi, and Here's Why. What happens when the article comes out? Do you hear from people?
Yes, I hear from lots of people. But actually, Marianne heard from way more people. And it was great for her at age 95 to hear from 90 years worth of people. Yeah. I heard from the usual crowd, you know. A lot of people are interested in the literary part of this. You know, how... There are lots of people interested in memoir, and I'm very interested in memoir. I'm writing a memoir right now. How do you write a memoir? This also speaks to your questions. How do you know why you're writing a memoir? I mean, people write memoirs for all kinds of reasons. They write for revenge. They write to commemorate people. They write to heal themselves. They write to try to understand things better. You know, there are all kinds of reasons to write a memoir. To get even with people, you know, to expose people who've hurt you. So it's the great text to engage with for writers. And that's most of the, from the New Yorker crowd, that's what I got. I got people who were really interested in A, why she wrote it, and B, how she wrote it. You know, she wrote it in the second person. She wrote it to Marianne, but she didn't know Marianne was alive then.
But on the German question, the lady who called me up and said, you know, that she lost people on the front, that her family didn't know what was going on. Did you hear from people who on either side of that?
No, I think people, especially younger people, are much more aware, maybe because they're more psychologically than politically driven. I think they are more aware of all the varieties of response in the culture. And I think there's something else, Alan. I think that if you read work, both scholarly and literary and journalistic, that's coming out of Germany today, there are so many different stories that have come out. And there have been films that have come out by kids of Nazis who are looking at their families. And, you know, there's an organization called One by One, which is made up of kids of Nazis and kids of Holocaust survivors that has been meeting for 10 years. There are other instances of German-Jewish dialogue that have been going on all over the world. There's one that's between Israel and Germany. And there's been so much interaction since then that it's really hard, for me at least, to have one idea of what a Holocaust survivor is, and one idea of what a German perpetrator is. There are many, many, many different kinds in both areas.
I don't know. Here I am, 72, almost 72 years old, and when I think about the Nazis, I think they didn't get what was coming to them, the survivors of the time. I make an argument about the children.
I agree with you about that the Nazis didn't get what was coming to them. I get furious when I hear about, you know, they've just discovered another Nazi who's in his 90s living in affluence wherever, whether it's in South America or North America, you know, in Canada, in Vancouver. But the point is that the kids really didn't ask to be born to these people. You know, they had nothing to do with it. And I think my mother was right about that. You can't have preconceptions about people who were born after the war. And also, your preconceptions can often be faulty. You know, I mean, we had no idea what Felix Maschmann was going to be like. We had no idea whether he was going to have adored his aunt or whether he was critical of his aunt. We had no idea. And it was refreshing. We spent 6 hours with him. We were going to have breakfast with him and just kind of chat. We wound up spending 6 hours with him because it was fascinating to hear about his struggles with this history. So, and I have to say, I've been to Berlin now twice. Mm-hmm. I find it difficult to be there. I mean, yeah. I go to Wannsee, and there's this gorgeous lake, a lot like the Stockbridge Bowl, you know, with sailboats and stuff. And I feel sick because I know what happened at Wannsee. On the other hand, you know, there are all these post-war people. There are all these kids running around. You know, it's very difficult. But I think that has more to do, you have to look inside and try and figure out what's going on with you about things instead of just saying, oh, you know, I'll never forgive him. He was a Nazi, always a Nazi, you know. I find it very, very difficult to be in a room with anyone who was in the Hitler Youth. That has happened to me, and I don't like it. But on the other hand, I just cannot blame or prejudge someone like Felix, who's younger than I am.
Sure.
Because he was Melita Mushman's nephew.
As I talked to this lady, I had the sense that she was convinced of all of the traditional stories that you hear. We didn't know a thing. We weren't really Nazis. You know, very few people were. And that there is a national ability to sort of say, in terms of rationalizing what had happened, that, you know, whatever it took to get out of it, they would have adopted that and have adopted that.
Mm-hmm. I think that's true of a lot of people. I don't like that at all. You know, if somebody says to me, if I'm in Germany and I'm with somebody who's 85 years old and he says to me, or she says to me, oh, I didn't know a thing about what was going on.
Sure.
I don't buy it. But on the other hand, I don't come across that very often. I mean, the Germans that I've interacted with tend to be under 60. And if anything, they are more interested in finding out about that period than I am in their country. Mm. But I meet a very select group of Germans. I meet artists and writers and scholars.
Eisenhower, apparently when he came into the camps, was infuriated by the explanation from the people. He made them all troop through there, at least that's what I've read, to see what had happened and the mayors and the rest, and to sort of force them to pay attention.
Yeah, that's true. But, you know, that was in 1945.
Sure.
And where are we? We're 2013 now.
Yeah.
Things change. And you're dealing with a different group of people. Obviously, I would not defend the neo-Nazis to anybody.
Yeah.
But, you know, the neo-Nazis are less than 20% of the German population. There's another 80% of people.
Doesn't that scare you, the 20%?
It does. It does. And it scares me that in Greece, the neo-Nazis in Greece are actually, as we speak, doing what the Nazis did in the 1930s. We have a friend, actually we're going to be publishing his essays, who's an Albanian immigrant to Greece. His name is Gazmend Kaplani. And he is a journalist also who has written a lot about Golden Dawn and has become a target of Golden Dawn. And if you look on YouTube, you will find many videos of Golden Dawn basically doing what the Nazis did in the 30s to Jews, upsetting stores, breaking windows, beating up immigrants. Pretty scary. And it's not happening in Germany as much as it's happening in Greece right now.
When you've been in Germany, when we were in Germany right after the wall came down, and I was there with a group of journalists, and we saw the gangs, the skinheads. What's happened? Has that dissipated? Or it still has to be against the law over there, which it seems to me is a pretty good signal that they still got a major problem over there.
They do have a major problem over there, Alan, but I would direct your attention to Michigan, sure. Idaho,
yeah.
as well as other places in Europe. I mean, France has a major problem with its right wing.
Sure.
Greece has a major problem with its right wing. And I would say that America has a great problem with its right wing.
I don't know, Helen. I mean, when I walked out of the Magic Flute in East Berlin and saw this massive gang of skinheads there, it was pretty scary. And I don't know that you see that walking down the streets of New York City.
Certainly not New York City. But I have a friend who's in Laramie right now.
Yeah.
And he just had an encounter with some neo-Nazis on the street right in the middle of Laramie. Now, Laramie is not a backwater. It's a university town. And it's a town with a history, as you know, of attention to racist and homophobic activity. And yet, here we are in 2013, and the neo-Nazis are walking down the street with swastika tattoos, with their heads shaved.
Your parents were communists, right?
No, they were not communists. They were social democrats. My mother had communist sympathies, and she had a lot of communist friends, but she was not a communist ever. And my father was very anti-communist. In fact, they left Czechoslovakia in 1948 because of the communist takeover.
So, in the end, you're a most impressive person when it comes to understanding other sides. I mean, that's what makes you a great journalist, a great writer. Wouldn't it be easier to just, hate?
Absolutely. It would. I think that's the reason most people do.
Yeah, you mean because it's easier?
Yeah, of course it's easier. It's easier to see things in black and white, always.
Well, as somebody who has done what you've done, which is to study this period of history and to give us these kinds of insights into it, I think we have to respect what you've come up with.
Thank you.
Our guest has been Helen Epstein. We've been talking with her. She's a theater music reviewer and a brilliant author. Helen, thanks so much for joining us. I hope that we'll be able to have you back many times. I'm Alan Chartok.
Thanks, Alan.
Been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org.